Before us, Senate Bill 397, Senate Bill 613, Senate Bill 622. Because we have some testimony to have from one of the members, we're going to reorder the work plan for this morning. We're going to Senator Harper is in the room. Senator Rondette, we'd like to have you forward. Senator Harper, welcome. We're going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 613. Good morning, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, my name is Steve Harper, Senator District 30. Senate Bill 613, promises kept, if you will. Simple little tax bill. We want to deduct the federal income taxes off our state income tax. That's a tax on a tax. We had a measure last that just passed out last fall that did a partial of this. Took the deductibility from $3,000 to $5,000. In our discussions in caucus the last session, we had long discussions on whether we should do this or not, what the framework should be. When we left it as we'll give the voters a partial bite at this, up at that $2,000, as I just mentioned, but we come back this session and finish it off. And 613 is part of that promise that I made to my caucus. It takes this thing and phases it in over a six-year period of time, and it's applicable only to personal income tax. That's what you have in front of you. Fairly simple. And that's where it came from.
Questions for Senator Harper? So the effect of the bill is nil until 2004.
It starts next biennium, that's correct. And it's phased in over a six-year period.
Okay. And of course, members, I'm certain, will understand that any enactment by the legislature in this legislative session would be subject to the support of future legislation.
Yeah,
future legislators.
That's why it's a statute.
Yeah. Questions at all?
Whose amendments?
Senator Minnis, the amendments. From where do the amendments come?
They came from LC. Apparently there was a problem with the way it was originally written. It didn't say what we wanted to say.
And so we activated the warranty clause on LC's contract.
I saw these about 5 minutes before you did.
Mr. Chair.
Question. Senator Castillo.
Thanks. I was wondering, you know, we had the Bill Sizemore measure that would have allowed more deductibility as a federal income tax, and voters said no to that. So how does this compare? Could you talk a little bit, just so for the record, people understand how this is, how this compares to what Sizemore had put forward?
Yeah, excellent question, Mr. Chair, Senator Castillo. Bill's measure, although there's some discussion of this, could have been retroactive, i.e. took place halfway through the budget cycle, so we would have had to have gone back and made actual cuts. This is all prospective. This is just like money coming out of your paycheck that you pay a bill with in the future that you never see. And it's phased in very, very gently over a six-year period of time. And it's just personal, so you don't have a corporate issue being raised. That's the main difference.
Okay.
It's all out in the future.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Question.
Senator Harper, I'm really curious about the reason that it doesn't have a revenue impact in 2001-03 is because it doesn't go into effect until further out. And I presume by that hand sign it means further out, just for the record. Do you have any proposals on where you're going to cut, given our budget considerations in this biennium, what you would do to make up those further cuts? Would you cut social programs? Would you cut education? Yeah. Where would your cuts come?
Well, actually, cut is not the correct term. There will be much more revenue than we have today. It just slows down the rate.
There will be?
Sure.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Great. I'm glad somebody in the building knows
yep.
that. That's excellent. Thank you.
Well, Senator Harper, I appreciate you bringing the testimony this morning.
Thank you.
You'll hear the rest of the testimony from Phyllis Rand, and Mr. Sizemore's in the room, so we can bring his own bushy-haired stranger has come this morning. Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Ferrioli and members of the committee, I'm Phyllis Rand, Capital Coordinator for the Governor's Commission on Senior Services, and I'm here to convey the Commission's opposition to Senate Bill 613. Now, I'm speaking just to the bill. The Commission has not seen the amendment, so I'm not aware of changes that the amendments make. Last autumn, every one of the state newspapers, almost all of the state major employers, and most importantly, Oregon voters, said the concept found in Senate Bill 613 was a bad idea. It was a bad idea last year when the expected budget deficit was $800 million. It's even a worse idea when the revenue projections for the next biennium have further decayed. So, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, scores of thousands of frail Oregon seniors and people with disabilities, young mothers trying to escape the welfare trap, and children who deserve a healthy beginning of their lives are in danger of losing even the most basic supports because of the gaping holes in the next budget. Senate Bill 613 would only compound our very serious problems. It's a bad bill and should not leave this committee. Thank you very much for your attention. And are there any questions?
Questions from the committee? I think that people understood the concept.
Thank you.
Mr. Sizemore. Good morning.
Morning, sir. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Phil Sizemore, Oregon Taxpayers United Executive Director, and the author of Measure 91 that has been discussed already a couple times, referenced at least this morning. I'd like to begin by saying that Senate Bill 613 says what Measure 91 should have said. Measure 91 was not really drafted to be placed on the ballot and pass. It was drafted to be submitted to this body as it was before we placed it on the ballot and said, here's what we are going to do. Why don't you do something else? And maybe you take out the corporations because we really don't care about giving them this benefit. But we got a better ballot title, if you will, if we included the corporations. We got a very simple ballot title that said that federal income taxes would be fully deductible for everybody, basically, if the measure passes. And we hope that this body would take an incremental step and say, well, let's not let that big, bad Billy Sizemore do something terrible, so let's go ahead and do something incremental. Didn't happen. We got Senate Bill, or was it, what ended up being Measure 88, came out of this body and was approved by the voters. The person who testified last, I think, oversimplifies the message that voters sent when they defeated Measure 91. Measure 91's defeat was defeat of a measure that could have been retroactive. I don't think it was, but it could have been. It was also defeat of a measure that would have done what this measure does all in one fell swoop instead of incrementally. And I thank Senator Harper for submitting this bill. It is a good bill because Oregonians still believe that double taxation is wrong. We asked Oregonians if they thought that federal income taxes should be fully deductible on state tax returns, and the response was 66-22, yes. But they didn't like the way we did it. And frankly, the way we did it was too quick, too much, all at once. And what this bill does is does that incrementally. It's interesting to note that even the federal government, the IRS, which we see beat up so much, doesn't even engage in this kind of double taxation. federal government lets you deduct all of your state income taxes on your federal tax return, so you're not paying income taxes on your income taxes. They even let you deduct all of your property taxes, so you're not paying taxes on taxes. True, you can't get away from double taxation altogether, but charging income taxes on income taxes is a kind of double taxation that just strikes people as being grossly unfair. To make people pay income taxes to the state on money that they never got to keep, that they had to pay to the federal government as federal income taxes, seeing that artificial number, whether it's $3,000 or $5,000 on your tax return, that when you add up how much federal income taxes you paid, you say, oh, I paid $7,400 in income taxes to the federal government, and I only get to deduct $3,000 or $5,000. What about the rest? I paid that out as taxes, but I don't get to deduct it. And many people out and about, and I know this is anecdotal, but stopping at Little League games where my son was playing or whatever, and people saying, Sizemore, I've never been with you on anything, but there's nothing ticks me off more than this limiting how much of my federal income taxes I can deduct on my state return. Makes people angry. It's not right. People felt that pretty much instinctively. I just want to say, the arguments that didn't wash against Measure 91, and I don't think a wash against this measure, this bill, when it becomes a measure and appears on the ballot, if this body doesn't pass it, which is probably the case, we don't really expect you to pass this. We can count to 16 and 31 and don't think it's going to happen. But putting it on the ballot, I'll tell you, the arguments that didn't wash last time were the class envy arguments, that this just benefits the wealthy. Somehow it's okay to double tax people if they make more money than other people do. I think that bothers a lot of people, that stirring up that pot of class envy. We saw a lot of that. And just in closing, brief remark, one of the things I hear so frequently from elected individuals is that the lottery is wrong. Taxing the ignorance of some people, who, especially those who have an addiction to video poker, is wrong, but we can't stop doing it because we need the money. People say that taxing people when they die and taxing the inheritance that they would leave to their children is just wrong. But we can't stop doing it because we need the money. Billions of dollars comes into the federal government that way. And I hear the same arguments with this issue of double taxing income. And people say, well, I know it's not right and it's not fair, but it's frankly the price tag is too high. We've got the poor and the needy and the schools and all these worthwhile causes that need the lottery money or the inheritance tax or the money from double taxation. So we need the money, so we can't pass this kind of legislation. Fact of the matter is, if it's ill-gotten gains, it's ill-gotten gains. I don't think you build communities by taxing people wrongly or unfairly. In spite of the fact that you have good things you'd like to do with the money, the way we get it counts just as much as how much we get. Thank you.
Question? Mr. Vice Chair.
Thank you. So, Bill, how would you change the tax system if it's unfair now? I mean, are we raising too much money, too little money? Should we be cutting things more?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, we work as an organization, Oregon Taxpayers United, at limiting the amount of money that government takes from people. That's what our job is to do. Believe in it. Believe that government's too big, taxes are too high.
What would you cut?
And I'm giving you that, with the chair's permission. It's every time we make a proposal, regardless whether it's to limit property taxes or dealing with the income tax, the argument that always comes forth from those on the other side is, okay, you want to lower this tax, but where are you going to cut? And frankly, every time I hear that, I feel like I'm copying out to tell the truth. The truth of the matter is, that's not my role, and I've never been elected to do it. And when we put a measure on the ballot that cuts taxes, we average being outspent about 10 to 1, sometimes 20
to
1.
Bill, get to the point. Yes, yes. You want to cut something or not?
Mr. Beyer, excuse me, with the chair's permission, I won't interrupt your question. If you let me answer you, I'll say this. It's not it's not my position to decide what will be cut. If it was my position, I would be glad to tell you in detail, and I have said publicly that there are many functions of government, and I've named specific functions that this body endorses that are not legitimate functions of government. And I, when I ran for governor, I put forth a budget. And in that budget, I increased spending for some functions, and I did not increase even for inflation other functions that we considered to not be legitimate functions of government, including especially the areas of human services that we think are the functions of charities, churches, relatives, friends, neighbors, clubs, but not the function of government, which is not capable of charity. And there are, if you want a hard answer to a so hard
leave,
question,
just,
I would
you'd
start
leave the
with
seniors and the disabled sir? Out in the street.
Senator Beyer, the
I'm getting tired of this crap. And he goes up and does this every
time. Yeah. That's right.
I mean, come on, give a real answer.
And, okay,
given the
poll, with the chair's permission.
The chair's style of conducting the hearing is to let the witness fully answer the question, even though that may test the patience of the members at times. And let's have a dialogue, but let's have full answers if the witness will continue.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I would begin, as I have stated publicly and to this body many times, with reining in the public employee retirement system, where you have, according to PERS themselves now, the average 30-year retiree is retiring on 107% of their highest working salary. And the with Social Security, more than 120%. Instinctively, I think most Oregonians realize that those in government are stretching to tell the taxpayers we don't have enough money to fund government when but we do have enough money for public employees to retire making more money than they did when they worked full time. I think that's stretches all reason, and to suggest that we can't cut a tax at a time when we are spending money so lavishly. Frankly, that's, I get a little indignant as the senator, Senator Beyer, gets a little indignant when we suggest that the caring for the poor and the needy and the elderly is a function of society and individuals and friends and relatives and churches, and it ought to be done voluntarily, not coercively by government. There's two sides to every argument. And every time we have an election, the other side spends a lot of money telling people all the dire effects will occur if you dare cut this tax. And sometimes people buy that argument, sometimes they don't. In this case, I don't think they bought it. I think they didn't like the fact that Measure 91 was not incremental. It was instant in its effect. And it had a huge price tag. It was not phased in. And this bill is wisely constructed, and we'll right a wrong and do it gradually. Thank you.
Questions for the witness? Senator Kirk?
Well, I just have a comment for Chair Beyer, and that's the old Sam Rayburn line that any jackass can tear down a barn. It takes a carpenter to build one.
Mr.
Chair? Senator
Beyer? I do owe Mr. Sizemore an apology. My emotions got the best of me, and I just strongly disagree with you, and I think you've been somewhat disingenuous with the public, and I understand that you don't feel a need to explain the impact of the cuts and that you have a constituency that you represent, and they pay you very well for that. So.
Senator Beyer, your apology is noted. I don't know if it's appreciated, but I appreciate it. The issue is one that does engender huge passions in people. The witness is correct when he says there's more than one side to every story. I appreciate that your concerns are legitimate concerns. And I'm not sure all of us agree that government has no function in helping to protect the weak or essentially build capacities within people that lack those capacities. It's a difficult role that we attempt to play. And Mr. Sizemore has testified to the fact that he's not elected to do it, and you are. Senator Minnis, question.
Yeah, actually, I think in a theoretical realm, I would agree with you, but in reality, in terms of what our current government looks like, absent charities doing the work that you're speaking of, government has to do it. I mean, for instance, if you were governor and you decided suddenly that you were going to shut off senior services division and developmentally disabled and so on and so forth, and all these other programs, where would all those people go?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, excellent point. And the answer to it is somewhat of a complex answer, and I'm actually prepared to speak to it, but it's not the subject of the day. I will be brief and say this, that when I ran for governor, I submitted a budget that actually did not cut in actual dollars any of those services that I considered to not be real functions of government. Instead, I held them where they were so that the percentage of the budget that was consumed by those services would grow smaller year by year. And the reason for that is because we, as Senator Minnis has noted, we live in a society where people have become accustomed to government being the provider of those services. And it is not apparent that there would be an instantaneous backfill by the private sector and by churches and by charities, et cetera, if the government stopped providing some of the functions, services that for the elderly and the disabled, et cetera. The only way we are going to get to the place where the private sector is filling that in, though, is if government stops usurping the responsibility for doing those things. And if, as they do so gradually, the others will fill in, and I think that's the step by President Bush to allow, for example, just one example, faith-based groups to help provide those services. Is an incremental step to doing that. I would never suggest that we stop today and say that 27% or so of the state budget that goes to human services, that we just stop doing it. I think that would be cruel. It would be cold-hearted. I don't suggest that we do it, but if it was up to me, we would gradually reduce the percentage of the budget that goes to those kinds of services and let the public know that it's your job to care for the poor and needy. And you can't get away from the fact that when government provides a service that helps the poor and needy, it is done essentially by putting a gun to people's heads and say, you're going to be charitable. We don't believe in you, public. We don't believe you'll take care of your fellow man, so we're going to force you to do it. We're going to put a gun to your head and make you do it. I say put a gun to your head, I mean that if you don't pay your taxes, we're going to garnish your wages, we're going to take your home, levy your checking account, your savings account. You are going to be charitable. We're going to make you be charitable. I don't believe you build society by doing that, and I think a lot of the, to some degree, lack of concern of their fellow man that we see in our society, and there's a lot of the opposite, but is because people feel, I don't need to take care of my next-door neighbor. I don't need to see if the little old widow lady's warm this winter because, you know, maybe she has oil in her tank, maybe she doesn't, but that we have a government function that does that. And I could go on, but this is not what the committee hearing's about.
Well, Mr. Sizemore, I appreciate the fact that you've made your point. The point is that taxpayers do deserve consideration in how government fulfills its functions by the assessment of taxes. The fact is there'd be little need for this building if government wasn't engaged in balancing equities and redistributing the benefits of society. It's the business that we are in. There are different philosophical approaches, and I believe that taxpayers need representation. Sometimes the representation that people need doesn't all come from within this building. That's why we have the initiative and referendum process. So I appreciate your testimony, and it's duly noted for the record.
You're welcome. Good day.
Is there anyone else here present that wishes to offer testimony on Senate Bill 613? Hearing and seeing none, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 613. Senator Corcoran has a comment?
Yeah, I do appreciate the fact that Mr. Sizemore was real clear about the fact that ballot measure 91 was a manipulation of the initiative process.
Well, Mr. Corcoran, that's an opinion that will stand in the record. Thank you. Questions, concerns, comments, hearing and seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on 613. We'll move to Senate Bill 622.
We have a bill that I believe needs an explanation from the legislative staff of legislative revenue, and perhaps we could have Laura Pryor and Mr. Bill Penhollow come up and help the committee understand what is the objective of Senate Bill 622. Good morning, Mr. Yates.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Mr. Yates with legislative revenue. all ready to talk about 397, so give me a second here.
Ready when you are.
The bill basically changes, well, let me back up for a second. As part of the way in which highway fund revenues are distributed, they go to the state for state use purposes, the state Department of Transportation. They're also about 60.05% goes to the state. About 24%, a little over 24%, is distributed to the counties, and the remaining 15% to the cities. Now, there are two separate allocations or modifications to that formula. One deals with cities, and the other deals with counties. One before you deals with counties, and this is a special allocation. They take about $500,000 away from the regular county distribution, and about exactly $250,000 from the distribution that would otherwise go to the Oregon Department of Transportation, and use these monies for counties which have the lowest per mile funding for arterial and major roads within the county. And what the bill does here is to change the basis in which that distribution is made. The distribution basically, first of all, you array all counties by the amount of money they have per mile of arterial and major highway. And then the county at the lowest, who has the least money per mile, is the first county to get money from this special allocation of $750,000. They continue to get money until they're brought up to the level of the second worst county. Then those two are brought up until they get to the level of the third, and so on. So you're backfilling the lowest counties, and you stop when you run out of money. Well, this is changing the basis, and I'm not real sure how. We need to talk about that, but it's changing the basis of how you compute which are the poorest counties by adding reserves to the definition of federal and state dedicated resources per mile. I don't know what reserves are. I don't know from the bill when you calculate those reserves, but there's clearly something intended there that needs to be talked about.
Okay. Well, let's find out what the intention is. And Judge Pryor, has Mr. Penhollow abandoned you in your hour of meeting?
He has. Perhaps discretion is the better part of valor. I'm not sure.
Ma'am, we'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 622, and you have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Once again, I'm back here on another issue that deals with small and rural communities. Just real quickly, a brief history of this. For a very long time, there was a small cities allotment. And until, I believe, this bill, I first put this in 1991, there had not been a small counties allotment. And I'm not exactly sure that I'm going to be able to answer all staff's technical questions. That's why Bill was here. That's why I needed him here. The bill worked very well until the timber decline and the counties that have timber revenues began falling into this small amount of money. And I'll use Harney County as the best example. Harney County, I believe, in the last distribution under this, received a check for over $400,000. And my county received $35,000. So I went back to the board, again, of the Association of Oregon Counties and said, look, so we've got a real problem with this. This was set up in the beginning for the counties that had the least to spend. And now those of you that do have some timber revenues in reserve are now falling into this amount of money. And Gillam and Sherman County don't have any timber at all. And for instance, Malheur County, which has many road miles. There's only 600 listed here, but I think they have far more than that. Used to be in the allotment as well, but it's been pushed out by Harney and Morrow. So the board said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I think if you have timber reserves, I think that you shouldn't be included in this. And they agreed to that. And Bill Penhall, staffed AOC, was here to support that, yes, the board had voted to support this word change. So I believe that the reserves, when you look at the county's budgets, and I may be wrong about this, I probably shouldn't even speak to this, but I believe when you look at the county's budgets, whatever is listed as reserves for their road department is what would be included here. And when would that occur? That would occur at the time that they're calculating the distribution.
Which is January 5th of each year.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, I'd be glad to take any questions.
Questions from the committee. Senator Miss?
Why would we want to do this?
Why would we want to do this?
Yes.
Because with what's happened, the original intent of the bill was not being carried out anymore. If you look at the list of the appropriations on that sheet that I passed out, you can see the counties, all 36 counties are listed by how much dedicated resources they have for roads per road mile. And this small amount of money, this $750,000, 500 of which comes out of the county's distribution themselves, they give that amount to the small counties. It isn't working anymore, and it wasn't working because the counties that had timber reserves that had not been included in the original bill. On the original bill on line 21, or on this bill on line 21, the language that's being added would get us back to what the original intent of the original bill was.
Again, I wasn't here when the original bill passed, I don't think, if it was, I wasn't on this committee. So what was the motivation? What were we trying to do by redistributing this money?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Menace, the original need that brought this bill forward was that the two of the counties, Sherman and Gillum County, do not have any timber resources at all. Mal here has like 2,000 miles of road or something, and they get very, very little timber revenue. So this was to try to bring some kind of equity to the lower end of the funding, the counties that had the least to spend per road mile, to try to help them have at least enough to be able to crush some rock for dirt roads. That was the original intent of the bill, to take the lowest county, give it a little bit of money, bring it up to the next county, give the next county a little bit of money and bring it up, and keep doing that until you had used up the $750,000. So you bring the lowest, you know, bring them up. And I'm not exactly sure how the small cities allotment, how that's distributed. Staff might be able to speak to that, Senator Menace.
Okay, let me see if I can. I think I've apprehended the point of this bill, which is a good thing because I sponsored it.
Thank you.
Yeah. The communities that received timber receipts, when those things tipped over, it prioritized the lowest receivers. In other words, there are several counties that were receiving quite a bit in federal timber distributions. That would be Baker, Grant, Crook, Douglas, Lane, Lynn, et cetera. So east and west. However, of the small counties or the least funded, it would be Baker and Grant and Crook, probably. Wasco for sure. But as the timber receipts tipped over, their allocations and reserves per mile dropped significantly. And so they would tend to move to the bottom of their statewide rankings and compete with those communities that never had timber dollars. That would be Gillum, Sherman, Harney, Morrow, and Wheeler. Wheeler had at one point in time significant timber revenues, but in fact the timber that was available for harvesting has been harvested. Harney has significant timber revenues, but there is very little harvesting on federal lands these days. Gillen, Sherman, and Morrow never did have timber in the federal program. So by making the timber reserve issue a part of the calculation, if Public Law 1608 goes into effect, and it will, the federal funds will flow back into those counties that have timber receipts or had timber receipts, but it won't be from harvesting timber. It'll just be a special appropriation. So those counties will get significant dollars. That would include Harney, Wheeler, Grant, et cetera. And, but they would still, in the current calculation, because of relatively low timber harvesting, appear as one of the lowest five. This basically adds reserves to the calculation. That would mean that some of those counties that are receiving the benefit of Senate Bill or Public Law 1608 would then move up the list and leave the counties that never did have timber receipts as part of their road fund at the lowest five levels, and they'd be first to get the distribution. This doesn't, as a matter of fact, change how the $500,000 is withdrawn for special appropriation or how the $250,000 is withdrawn from the Department of Transportation. If we do nothing, that will still happen, and they'll still be distributed. But if we make this one-word change, adding the reserves, what it does is truly take the lowest reserve and income and put them on in the highest priority for the distribution of these dollars. Am I correct?
Thank you, Senator Ferriola.
Long hop, but we got this. So, the, colleagues, what you have before you is essentially a way to truly prioritize the lowest resource counties at the highest priority for the distribution of these dollars that are already reserved for that purpose in the current law. Does that answer your question, Senator Menace, why we should do this?
Sort of, but I'm kind of a picture guy, so it's not a flow chart.
Okay.
I think I understand what they're talking about, but I'm not.
Yes, Mr. Yates, do you have some clarity to add?
No,
to my
no, I just.
I was hoping.
As I said to begin with, I was unsure what reserves meant, and within the context of the discussion, I guess it is the timber reserves.
Yes.
And I'm presuming that that would mean that would apply only to U.S. forest distributions.
It would.
And only the 75%, which is dedicated to the county road funds.
Yes.
That would be that would be my assumption as well. That's where those reserves come from.
Yeah.
Okay. Further questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Ma'am Castillo.
So that I'm clear on how this would work, and I would like to see a flow chart too. It would be helpful. Are we talking about redistributing the pot in any way, or are we talking about taking new money and applying it to help certain counties with their road fund help? Or are we talking about taking the pot and redistributing how it gets allocated?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Castillo, there's only $750,000 that we're talking about here.
Okay.
It's $500,000 that all 36 counties together, when they get the distribution, they take it right off the top before it's distributed to any county, and we've been doing that since 1991 when the bill first passed.
Okay.
We take $500,000, and ODOT matches that off of their distribution with $250,000. And they put those together, and that amount of money is then distributed. And the way it's distributed, it's by this list of counties. They're ranked from top to bottom.
From bottom to
top. Bottom to top.
To
from the worst to the best. Well, from those that have the most to spend per road mile, which is Multnomah County, $56,900, down to the smallest, which unfortunately is Gillen County, with $1,718. And that $700,000 then is, it takes Gillen County and gives it enough money to come up to Sherman County. It gives Sherman County enough to come up to Harney County. It gives Harney enough to come up to Malheur, at least until you keep going that way, until you've used up that $700,000.
It bumps up. It doesn't. It's not a new pot of money.
No.
It's not more money.
No.
It bumps up the lowest to the next level.
It's distributed laws class.
Yes.
And what this does is actually adds in the reserves that the counties have been able to squirrel away as part of the total, because in fact the reserves are also available to the local county for roadwork. But the anomaly here is that reserves can be built by federal forest receipts, or in this case, there's going to be a new distribution that's already happening, and that's going to change, or could potentially change the mix. It simply concentrates on those counties that don't have access to federal forest receipts. And it calls, you know, it actually maybe fairly prioritizes them as the lowest of the low, since they don't have another source of funding.
Senator Ferrioli, if we were to see this list again, I believe at the first of next year, if you do nothing, if this committee chooses not to act on this bill, and if we see this list, if it's redone next January, we will see at the low end still Gillum, Sherman will still be there. I would imagine that Malheur, it'll be Gillum, Sherman, and Malheur. Because with the new safety net money coming in, it will put everybody back, you know, where they have been in the, or very close to where they've been in the past.
Okay. Further questions from the committee? We're not scheduled for a work session on this today, so we have some time to think this through a little better and possibly hear from some other counties that may be activated in question of this issue. But bottom line is that this it's a small amount of money, and the bottom line is that it raises by maybe a few hundred dollars per, or not even a few hundred, but several dollars per road mile. Judge Pryor talked about this as being a ability at least to crush gravel to cover dirt roads. Judge, what's the percentage of dirt roads in your county?
90%.
90% mm-hmm. of gravel or dirt in your county.
Mm-hmm.
And since we distribute these dollars on a per capita basis, naturally, Multnomah, Washington, and others have huge distributions in relative terms. Okay. Senator Dennis.
On line 21, where it defines federal and state dedicated resources, means all county road fund resources.
Yeah.
And you're adding the words and reserves. So the problem arises because reserves are somehow not considered to be part of those fund resources?
Senator Ferrioli, Senator Mesh, yes.
It seems to me it would be. How did it exclude it?
Senator Mesh, I can address that one. County road resources are current year income. Reserves go into a different category. They're actually not counted as current resources, and I think it's just a matter of definition.
Well, all county road fund resources sounds like all county road fund resources. I mean, unless, is that defined somewhere else?
Well, there are some exceptions. For instance, there's an anomaly that allows Grant County to declare surplus reserves and then spend those dollars on education. So reserves, in fact, are not the same as resources by technical definition.
What technical definition? Well, give me the authority for it.
Maybe that's the thing that we could ask our...
Where is that in staff?
Our staff to bring forward for us when we actually have the next public hearing and work session on this bill.
Yeah, I would like to know that.
And I think that may be the piece of the puzzle Mr. Penhollow could have asked.
I'm sure he could have.
Okay. Where did he disappear to?
Well, we've got an all points bulletin out for him right now.
Tell him we just killed his bill.
And Judge Pryor at the same time.
It was a double homicide. We need a good detective.
A quick buy a case of donuts.
Uh-oh. Right. Is it going to be a long investigation?
No. Well, Judge Pryor, I think what we've done is we've educated the committee on the purposes of the bill. We need some technical questions answered, and that's the job before the committee, is to get the technical questions answered.
Thank you.
Further questions? Hearing and seeing none. Any other person here present that wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing and hearing none, we will cancel the APP on Mr. Penhollow, and we'll expect him to appear at the next public hearing on Senate Bill 622. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 622. We will move then to what I think will be a spirited debate on
Senate Bill 397. Open the public hearing on Senate Bill 397, and we'll request our able staff to capture for the committee what is the purpose of Senate Bill 397.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to give you a short slideshow to do that.
All right.
I can bring my computer back to life. Well, it was a big deal. Okay. This is kind of a new area in terms of the Revenue Committee dealing with unemployment compensation tax system. So I wanted briefly to go through, at least as the structure of the tax relates to the bill before you, which is Senate Bill 397. And basically, what you have is a system where employers basically report quarterly to the Employment Department. The forms come from the Employment Department, and they include the tax rate that the employer has to pay. So the employer does not have to compute the tax rate. The employer doesn't have to go through all of these schedules that you see in the bill. The Employment Department has to deal with those schedules. They determine the tax rate, and the employer simply multiplies the quarterly payroll, covered payroll, by that tax rate to determine the tax that they remit. And then the Employment Division, as I said, determines the tax rate, and they determine that based on the employer's experience. We'll get into this a little bit more later, but basically we're talking about the history of how much of the employer's payroll has been paid out in benefits to unemployed people, so that the Employment Division is tracking both the payroll, the wages that the employer is paying, and also benefits that are paid to previous to people who were previously employed by that employer. The other thing that's important in the determination of the tax rate is the balance in the Unemployment Compensation Trust Fund. So it's these two things that the department is looking at to determine what the tax rate is. Where the money goes, basically most of it goes into the Unemployment Compensation Trust Fund, and it's from that fund that the benefits are paid to unemployed workers. This system of tax rates is before you also funds the Wage Security Fund, and this pays wages for people that are left with, you know, balance due at Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Okay, and they tend to end up pretty low, and they would have to wait a long time before they would get those wages out of any bankruptcy settlement. This pays their wages up front.
Dick, is that technically a diversion?
Separate tax.
Minor diversion.
No, it's a separate.
Heads behind you shaking. Under federal law, I think it's classified as a diversion, right, Erlina?
Good. I'm glad their heads behind you.
It is a new area.
Okay. There's really three questions I want to deal with here, and that's why are there two sets of eight schedules in this bill? All right. Secondly, why are there eight schedules in each separate group? And thirdly, why are the schedules graduated? Okay, so let's look at those questions. Two groups of schedules, basically, to the employer, it doesn't make any difference in the sense that they're going to pay the same amount of tax. The question is where the money goes. But what you have in the first section, section one of your bill, deals with ORS 657-439, and what that does is to impose a separate tax of 3% for the wage security fund, 0.03%. Then it reduces all of the other rates that provide money for the Unemployment Compensation Trust Fund by 0.03%. Now, that's not quite true, because these schedules are all pegged at 5.4% at the top end, and that one rate doesn't change. It's the same. But for everybody else, the rate is reduced by 0.03%, and that money goes into the Wage Security Fund. And this schedule is only in effect one quarter for each biennium. That's the first quarter of the biennium. Then the second section in the bill takes effect for the other seven quarters of the biennium. And there's no money that comes out of the second schedule for the Wage Security Fund. It all goes into the Unemployment Compensation Fund. So that's why you have two groups of schedules. The schedule, in effect, basically each September, you're determining which of these eight schedules is going to be in effect. And what you're trying to do is, what you're looking at is the trust fund balance, how much is in the trust fund. Secondly, you're trying to estimate what you would pay out in the next upcoming calendar year. Okay, so you're looking at it in September, say this September, and you're looking at calendar year 2002 and saying, how much would we pay out in benefits if we were in a recession? And you're saying that the desired balance in that unemployment account is enough actually to pay 18 months. So it's not just the calendar month, calendar year, but it's 6 months beyond that. So what you need is a fund balance of 150% of your estimated benefit payments under recession. So that's kind of the ball game that we're operating in. The basic calculation is, first of all, it's easy. You determine as of August 31st, before September, what the balance is in the trust fund. And then you estimate the benefits under recession for the upcoming calendar year, whatever calendar year that is. Now, there's two benefit calculations. There are two calculations upon which you make the estimate of benefits. The first is based on 10 calendar years of experience. We're really going back for a period of 120 months. And for each of these, you compute what you would call a moving sum. So you start out to begin with a January through December in that first year of the 10-year period. Then you go February through January, March through February, and you proceed on through that 10-year period, and you've actually got 109 data points. You go through there. And what you do for each one of those is you get a sum of the total wages paid and a sum of the benefits that were paid during those periods from those wages. You're always dealing with covered wages in this case, and benefits that are paid from them. And then you divide those two out, you get a ratio for that period, which they call...
You ever feel like Moses? Talk about unemployment tax, the lights just start shaking. We're having a brownout.
When I move in that direction, you always bring me back to Earth. Anyway,
he just looks like Moses.
I need something to curl my hair.
Is it true you both went to Willamette University?
Anyway, for each of these periods, you get a benefit cost ratio, which is the benefits paid actually to wages. And then you look for the highest one. What's your worst experience? When during those 108, 12-month periods were benefits highest relative to wages paid? And you select that as what they call the high benefit cost period. And you start your calculation then with the benefits that were paid during that period. So it's the worst experience you've had in the last 10 years. Now, if you're thinking about Oregon right now and you're thinking about, you know, the forecast that was presented in the comments, was, wow, we've had a 10-year period with no bad periods. Okay, we'll get to that in a second. But there's a second calculation which deals with that situation. But anyway, you find the worst period during the last 12 years, and then you adjust. You start with the benefits that were paid in that worst 12-month period, and then you adjust those to current employment levels, and you adjust them to current benefit levels. So you say, if we had a similar type experience in the current market, current environment, what would it cost? So you're estimating that calendar year, upcoming calendar year. Okay, the second method then is sort of a minimum, and this is based on experience roughly for 1975. And what this says is just take 3.3% of your average monthly employment at times your average weekly wage. And that becomes the floor, and that's what's been used the last few years since the experiences in the early 80s, which were much worse than 75, have dropped out of the 10-year calculation period. Okay, so what you do then is you calculate a fund adequacy ratio, which is to take that balance that was in the trust fund and divide it by the highest estimate that you've made here, the benefits that you're going to pay out in the up. Okay? Running through the calculation for 2001, just to give you some numbers to look at, the fund balance was $1.7 billion. The first estimate, which was for this period, this was the high-cost period, April of 91 through March of 92, actual benefits for that period, $371 million. The adjustment for employment was a 30% increase in employment now for the upcoming calendar year relative to the experience in 91, and a 40% increase in benefits for current benefit levels relative to the levels in 91.
So that's the inflation factor?
Yes. So that brings you to an estimate of $677 million is what you would expect to pay out in the upcoming calendar year if you had an experience like the one you had in 91. Now, if you use the alternative calculation, it's $921 million. That minimum, that 75 experience was much worse than 91. And so it's saying the benefits that you want to prepare for and protect the fund against are higher, and in fact, you're more likely to spend out, if it's a bad situation, $921 million. So again, you take the highest of these two figures and you divide, you come up with a ratio of 190%. So that says right now, with the balance you've got of $1.7 billion in the trust fund and what you would expect to pay out under your worst scenario, you've got 190% of what you need. The target's 150, so you're above where you need to be. And this is sort of a comparison of where you want to be is in green. That's sort of in the range around 150%. If you're in that range, you're on schedule four, and the average rate right now, given the rates that are in the bill, is about 2.5%. And these three rates in red are the ones that are changed in the bill. All the rest of them remain the same. At 190%, you're actually up here in the fuchsia, or whatever that is.
Well, he really is a sensitive New Age guy.
Where'd you reveal his political party?
Independent.
Which puts you in Schedule 2 and means that the average rate would drop to about 1.75%. So you can see what happens and why there are these different schedules. It takes it out of the hands of the Employment Division and makes it automatic. Go through the calculation, and it tells you what the tax rates are going to be. They're going to be according to Schedule 2, given the calculation that was made in September of 2001. September of 2000. They're not 2001 yet. I haven't made that calculation. And had the fund been lower, the balance been lower, you would have been down in a different schedule, and the rates would have been increased to try and maintain that fund balance at 150%.
So if our unemployment goes up, we slide into recession, then next year the rates would automatically be adjusted up?
The expectation as you move these calculations and as you look at the forecast as it came out, is that, yes, the experience is going to be worse, and it will tend to draw the fund down, and it's going to tend to move you down into these lower schedules over time. So while we're in Schedule 2 right now and the changes in the bill won't matter, The forecast draws us down into Schedule 3 and Schedule 4 eventually, where these new changed rates do in fact apply.
Don't we have a built-in fail-safe mechanism here in addition to the double conservative approach? That is, you've taken your worst 10-year scenario, then you've taken your worst experience ever, and you've got two weights that build the current 190% reserve, 150 being probably safe enough. But if we get, if we have an experience that approximates 1971 or 19, you know, the recession of 80s, the place where we actually had to have a serious reconsideration of budget bills, don't we automatically get into special session situations? If we have the significant downturn that generates larger than expected payoffs, won't we also end up in a budget cutting situation for state agencies? And wouldn't that indicate a special session as we've done in the past?
You may be beyond me in terms of ability to answer that question. As you know, you've got your problems here with the legislature, but we're talking about a fund which deals with making payments of benefits to individuals, and whether or not you cut programs doesn't really affect that.
Right. But I guess maybe that's just an observation for the panel to consider, the idea being that if we're accruing at 190% on the worst case scenario being generated is 150%, and we're clearly accruing more than that, I'm just going to suggest that if we get into worse deep water than that, we're going to be in special session anyway. Senator Byer, excuse me.
Well, I think, Mr. Chair, though, the issue is that really this is a fund, this is essentially an insurance program.
Yes.
That has little to do with what the legislature does. It's really the effects on the private side.
Well, I understand that. I guess my point was the accrual amount, the rate, could be changed along with other issues if this organization came back in a special session.
I suppose that's true. But I guess I'm curious, and I don't know whether Dick has a history on this or not. Seems like I'm trying to remember the 80s and the 70s before that.
There's a reason that you can't remember them.
Yeah, probably a good reason. Yeah. the fact that I remember seriously suggests I probably can't remember any of it anymore. But it strikes me that what Congress does when we go into those periods is they increase, they started extending the benefit periods beyond the initial, was it 35 or 36 weeks? It seems like at one point we were up to over a year of benefits. Do they totally pay for that, or does that have to be reflected in the match rate?
You know, these are good questions, and I'm not the person.
Yeah, I got.
Why
you.
Don't Senator Bart? Why?
Sorry, Dick.
I'm going to let Dick excuse himself and bring up Verlina Crosby.
When he's done, yeah. Okay. I can wait until we get to that.
I just got a couple more slides here. Okay, the last question is then why are the schedule graduated? And the reason is basically that the department is required to recognize merit in the sense of prior experience when you compare the wages paid by an employer to benefits that are paid from to his prior employees, so that you get an experience there, a reflection of how much the employer retains his work staff as opposed to how much they turn over and draw unemployment. So what you have to do is for every employer, you have to, in fact, build a total for a year's period of the benefits chargeable to that employer and of the wages, the covered wages that are paid by that employer, and you get a benefit ratio then for each employer. And then you list all employers and sort by that ratio so that the person who has the best experience in the sense of least number of his employees become unemployed and are paid unemployment benefits, you start with that person and you go all the way down to the, you know, the construction workers and so on that are sort of cyclical and have frequent periods of where staff is laid off, a lot of unemployments are drawn, that sort of thing. You get down to the bottom. And for this list that you have a list of all wage total wages paid, or you have a list of employers, and for each employer you have the benefit ratio and the total payroll of that employer, and then you add up a cumulative total of all benefits as you go through this list. So when you get to the bottom, you've got the total of all wages paid to the state of Oregon, 100% for that period. And then it's that place in that distribution that determines what your rate is by this schedule. If you look at the schedules and how they're written, the groupings here are based on the cumulative taxable payroll and what percentage you're in. So your place in that list determines where you fall in the schedule and whether you pay a rate of, you know, 0.005% or 5.4%. And what the rates that it, the schedules that are actually there, and again, I'm not exactly sure why they're shaped exactly the way they're shaped, but if you look at the red is the one that's in the law, that's current law, and the black is what's proposed, the reduction for Schedule 3, which is, I should have used Schedule 4 because the reduction is a little bigger. But basically, it's the same. What you see is the top end of the schedule doesn't matter. It's unchanged, and it goes up very rapidly for the employers with poor unemployment experience, or in the sense that they have a lot of payment, benefit payments. And it's just downward shifted, basically, and fairly linear throughout this period. It's linear and increasing at about 0.01% at the low end, then it's increasing a little more rapidly in here, about 0.02% as this goes up. But anyway, that's what the schedule looks like. That's what I have to say.
Great. Thank you. Let's move forward, gentlemen. We have 15 minutes in this morning set, and I'm going to get through the public hearing. Senator Beyer.
I'm just going to ask Dick, and do we have the ability to set the rates, or are those set by federal law?
Mr.
Yates, might just wait until...
Well, there's a good question for Ms. Crosley. Ms. Crosley, would you bring your...
bailing out of that show. Good move, Dick.
We have that authority within limits.
Good morning, Ms. Crosley.
Good morning. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Berlina Crosley, and I am the director for the Oregon Employment Department. I have with me Frank Ritchie, and he's the manager of unemployment insurance programs and analysis, and he actually works with the actuarial part of the trust fund. I think I'll go, if I could, Mr. Chair, over our testimony and then come back to maybe some of the questions that Senator Beyer has, if that's okay.
Okay.
In ORF 657-615, there is a part of that statute that requires or at least allows the Employment Department Director to come to the legislature and also recommend to the governor when there needs to be a change in the tax rates. And that's essentially why we're here, to talk about the tax rates, whether they should be increased or decreased. We've actually been talking about that particular potential for about the last three sessions as we forecasted whether or not we were going to have a good economy or a worsening economy. Because Oregon has been in a relatively good economy for about the last 10 years, and we have a very healthy trust fund and unemployment insurance, the amount of interest has been higher than what we have experienced in past times, even under this mechanism that Mr. Yates went through. And because of that, it is large enough now, that interest factor alone is increasing significantly the fund, and that is the primary reason why we're in front of you today asking for a difference in the tax tables. The bill, as Mr. Yates talked about it, is really just filled with a bunch of tax tables, but it does essentially three things. It adjusts and lowers the tax rates in three of Oregon's eight unemployment insurance tax rate schedules. It moderates the change from one tax schedule to another in the two, if you were going to stay in the Schedule 2 and then move from 3 to 4. And I'll come back to that because it, for the picture people and Senator Minnis, I think we do have a picture that will make that a little bit clearer. And it also reduces the amount of taxes that employers are paying into the unemployment insurance trust funds for that 3, 4, and 5. The main thing I want to make...
Question, Senator Castillo.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. How does our trust fund compare to other states? It's my understanding that we have the healthiest, if not one of the healthiest trust funds in the country.
Mr. Chair and Senator Castillo, we do have probably one of the top five in the nation as healthy trust funds goes. Many states actually have, we have a forward-funded tax schedule and also benefit trust fund, which means we basically raise taxes in a good economy, or at least keep them higher in a good economy, so we won't have to borrow, or so we don't have to raise taxes in a downturn economy. Some states don't do that, many, and actually I would say most states do not do that. They actually project what they think that they're going to need to cover the benefits in the future. They don't do the mechanisms that Mr. Yates was talking about, where you look at the worst times over the last 10 years, et cetera, and it doesn't have a solvency factor in the same way. So we are one of the healthiest trust funds.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, can we ask a
question?
Yeah, it sounds like the state's doing a great job at managing and keeping that very healthy. I was also wondering, I know that, or I've heard that we had a $90 million reduction in the employer rates this year for the fund, and this proposal, you know, is to lower them again. Is that pretty typical of how we make decisions or how we manage the fund? I mean, do we do, you know, several years of reductions, or does that usually not happen in that pattern, or can you kind of...
It generally does not happen in the patterns where we're decreasing by that significant amount, Mr. Chair and Senator Castillo. I think it might be helpful to go now to a chart. You should have something like this in front of you. It has eight schedules. Yes. Because it goes to your point about how we have decreased or increased taxes. Mr. Yates showed you one, kind of the stack bar, if you will, approach. This one actually shows the schedule, and if you were in Schedule 4, this is basically how the tax schedules work. If you were in Schedule 4, the middle, that is what you would call the optimum schedule. That means that we would be collecting the same amount of taxes as we were paying out. If you move to the 5 through 8, that means that we are paying out more on a projected, and also those ratios that he was talking about, that we estimate that we would be paying out more than what we would be recovering under the 4. And so we basically and essentially increase the taxes. And you can see that when you looked at the 10 years back, in 1982, that was the worst recession we've had. So until about 1992, when we went back and looked at that, that artificially was keeping the tax rates high because the worst time was the worst. and then after those came out and we lowered taxes because of that, we called a press conference, and the big decrease for employers was accommodated because 1982 basically came out. Now we have, in 1994, you can see we were in Schedule 1. In 1995, we went to 2. And then we went to Schedule 3, and we've been in Schedule 3 for quite some time, and we were still over-recovering, even though 3 was supposed to be dragging down the growth, and it was, but it wasn't dragging it down enough. And so we lowered it to the rate 2, or Schedule 2, excuse me, and that, Senator Castillo, was to your point about the $90 million reduction. There was a $90 million reduction for that calendar year, primarily because we were still increasing too fast.
Senator Bennett.
To what extent does this proposal anticipate the slowing down of our economy, the increased experience of unemployment filings, and a reduction in interest earnings?
Mr. Chair and Senator Menace, we have looked at the March forecast and with the lower interest, and we still are in front of you asking for the decrease because it would still be growing.
Why?
Pardon me?
Why?
Why are we still doing? Because it's still not.
It seems ridiculous. And I say that as a Republican who's been trying to get information from the State Accident Insurance Fund with respect to their portfolio and can't seem to get information. All of the reasons they're stating to me why their rates reserves need to be where they are the same reasons why I shouldn't vote for this. The experience rate, if I'm looking at the economy, interest rates are declining and the markets, the stock market's going down. That's what's produced the increase in your portfolio. I'm watching layoff after layoff around the Northwest, and you're sitting here in front of our committee telling me that somehow prudent to do this. I don't understand that. It sounds to me like you haven't done any planning at all.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Minnis, I'm not sure exactly how you have come to that conclusion.
Well, I haven't seen anything in front of me today that justifies this proposal.
Okay, I'm not sure exactly what you would ask to...
Well, how far in the future have you looked in terms of reductions in interest rates or interest earnings on your portfolio, and what is your projected experience rate with respect to unemployment? When I talk to the people at SAFE, they tell me they can't predict it, and they're buttoning down the hatches because they're expecting that we're going to have a slowdown that's going to be significant and severe. We don't know whether that's ultimately going to happen or not, and you guys are in here telling me happily that we ought to reduce this fund. Makes no sense to me. I'm just a dumb, gumshoe cop. I don't...
Anybody here believe that? I think the question the Senator Minnis asks is an excellent question. The fact of the matter is, if we are over-accruing, which is apparent from the charts, how does that connect with the experience projected, which the good senator accurately recaptures as lowering interest, higher unemployment, and potentially rocky period ahead of us? How do we reconcile those things?
Okay. If I could just maybe go through, and then I'll ask Frank to kind of take you through some of the actuarial numbers. We've actually projected it through 2005, mm-hmm. and we would be projecting that we would be increasing from where we are at 2 now up to 4, which is the optimum rate, and I'll let you let Frank walk you through those. Senate Bill 397 does not change the trust fund solvency. That's the main thing that we were talking about. So that 150% is still where we're headed for. And it does not affect the experience rating for the employers. And it also does not affect the department's budget because it is a dedicated fund. And people have asked, how does this maybe affect the administrative costs for the department? There are actually two different types of taxes that employers pay. One is through the Internal Revenue Service, and it goes back and then comes to Washington, D.C., and comes back to us for running the programs. And then there is the Benefit Trust Fund that is only for the benefits for unemployment insurance. And they are two separate taxes. The taxes that employers pay through the Internal Revenue Service, however, employers can take and do take a credit that they do pay the state for the trust fund. And so that is important because they do work together, but they do obviously work separate as well. Oregon has used a forward funding approach because when there's no small or no trust fund immediately or after a recession, the state would have to borrow at high cost to pay benefits. They would have to reduce benefits to workers, raise employer taxes, or do a combination of all three. What we have done is look at 18 months worth of covering the benefits, and also we looked at the trend to see where we would eventually get to that Schedule 4. One of the primary reasons that we have still come before you to ask for this reduction is that when we go from 2 to 3, then 3 to 4, we call that a reverse cliff effect. In other words, when we would be going, remember we've been lowering, but now when we would be going up to those higher taxes, we would like to smooth those, not make them as obtrusive to employers' taxes as it would be if we stayed in the current tax tables. So we would still move, but we would not move to the amount that we would be under the current tax tables. And
in simplest terms, Ms. Crosley, what I'm hearing you say is that the relatively better performance that we've experienced in the past decade has accrued sufficient so that if there is a turnaround, these are the times when we would use those reserves and spend those reserves back down to 150% of the total.
Mr. Chair, that is absolutely correct. And the concern that we've got is that if we...
Question, Senator Cassidy.
I'm sorry, I'll ask it when you finish answering.
Okay. The concern that we've got is if we just stayed with the same tax tables, that we would still, because of the mechanisms that Mr. Yates talked about, those would still be in effect. We'd still be looking back and we'd be looking forward about what kind of rates we'd be paying out under a worse scenario, if you will, or even a better scenario under a moderate recession. But at the same time, we would be then increasing taxes fairly significantly.
Right. So the rate jump causes us to accrue additional.
That's correct.
And what you're suggesting is that that additional accrual and what we have in the reserves represents almost an unconscionable amount of taxation and reserve, so that if we ramp down a little bit in the accrual, then some of the reserve that was put aside for this very occurrence would be used, and the burden would be lightened on the employer. How does this affect the employee?
The employee's tax rate, benefits are not affected at all.
Okay. Senator Miss, did that get at your question?
No.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Castillo.
So before implementing, aside from implementing this bill, how do our tax rates compare, having done the $90 million reduction in employer rates this year? Does that bring us, I understand the need to be sensitive to our rates compared to other rates and that we should be, comparable. So how does it work for employers with the $90 million reduction? Where does that currently put us with other states in terms of rates? And then, in addition to that question, where will we be compared to other states in our rates if we pass Senate Bill 397?
Mr. Chair and Senator Castillo, I'm not sure I have the information for the last part of your question, although I could get that. We have been, for about the last 3 years, probably in the top five highest tax rates for unemployment insurance.
Okay.
Not all of it is because of our mechanisms that we're talking about today. And according to my research staff, the two primary reasons are that we were a growing state, we're an in-migration state, meaning people come here and they are unemployed and they are on, benefits. The other primary reason is that we tend to be a higher than other state seasonal type of state for the types of employment that we have. But we were in, for a long time, we were about the fifth highest. I got many questions from different states and many employers who were moving here regarding that fact. The last time I looked, we were around the 14th. I believe it was around the 14th.
With the reduction we had this year? Okay.
Yes. Correct. And I don't know, Senator Castillo, as I said, where we will fall, because every state's going through their legislature, and they will be looking at their tax rates as well, so I don't have the answer to your last question.
Thank you.
Senator Byrd?
Thank you, Ms. Chair. It's almost a misnomer to call it a tax rate. Essentially, we're talking about an insurance program.
Correct.
And I think to get to Senator Minnis's question, I'm curious about as your actuarial assumptions see those numbers, and I guess the question is, is this essentially set internally? Is there any external actuarial review at all?
Mr. Chair and Senator Beyer, we have had two actuarial reviews that we contracted and had them come in and look at ours. And the solvency rates that we are recommending to you today to get down to, even with the reverse cliff smoothing, is still within those two actuarial reviews. And those were done probably about 4 or 5 years ago, but we are still within those actuarial projections. The Federal Department of Labor also looks at, from state to state, whether or not they believe our funds are solvent, and we are and still will be within those rates as well.
How much of the earnings or the accumulation of capital in the fund is a result of interest earnings versus payments?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, for the record, my name is Frank Ritchie. I'm manager of unemployment insurance programs and analysis for the Employment Department. For the last several years, we've been approaching $100 million a year in interest earnings, and this last year we just went over $100 million as far as earnings by interest.
What's proportionally?
And the taxes last year were just over $500 million in taxes. Now, they'll go down this coming year because we've got the statute.
Who invests? Is the fund invested through the Investment Council?
Mr. Chair and Senator Beyer, there's two types of investments that go on. about 1.5 billion is invested at the National Treasury. We have nothing to do with it, and it is invested for us by the Department of Labor, although it is kept in trust for Oregon. No other state can use it for any other benefits in Oregon.
My turn on that one was good.
Sure. And then there...
Oh. I'm going to need one of those ways and means flow charts. Okay. Kind of stuff you're used to producing for ways and means.
Okay.
Can you help?
Absolutely.
Okay. Other questions?
Mr. Chair?
Did you have a...
And then there's a large diversion, given your earlier question, that the legislature did, which diverted about $230 million that is invested by the state treasurer's office in Oregon. It is those two amounts then, and that has been running right around 7%. Interest, if you will, on that 200 and some million. The two of those are together when we look at what the tax rate should be.
It would be helpful for me to see that in a graphic way, just to see what the convergence or spread is happening, just to better understand. I'm a visual person.
Sure.
Colleagues, the hour has come to adjourn the meeting, but Mr. Wilson and Lisa Tressel are both here from outside the building, Senator. And I'm not sure that it's convenient for them to return to make testimony on this bill, so I'd like to... Would it be possible for you to add additional testimony at another hearing? Or I guess the chair's decision then is to go ahead and adjourn the meeting after Senator Castillo's next question, and then ask J.L. Wilson, Lisa Tressel, and Joe Gillum to come back along with Steve Lanning from AFL-CIO so that we can get a fuller picture of the effect on employers. We are not scheduled, and we're not scheduled for a work session on this bill this morning, so I think it gives Ms. Crosley an opportunity to produce those graphics that are necessary to answer some of the members' questions. And I urge you to do that with all possible speed, and then Senator Castillo has the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's my understanding that the way that our system currently works, we have an automatic triggering system to keep our healthy, to keep our fund safe and protected that automatically triggers rates up or down depending on how it's functioning, and that this bill is an additional adjustment to the rate beyond how it automatically triggers.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Castillo, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Could I add one more comment? It is also a standalone bill in that if there are other pieces of legislation that would either increase benefits or increase the coverage or divert, as Senator Beyer was talking, if there was a diversion bill, then this bill would need to be looked at because it does stand alone. It says if the laws that are in effect stay in effect,
okay,
this should happen.
Okay. Thank you.
Colleagues, we will pick up this issue when we can schedule it next in consideration of our requirements for notice. We'll expect additional information from the Department of Employment. So with that, we'll adjourn. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 397. We'll adjourn until tomorrow morning at 8:30.